All right, a few announcements before we begin. Just to remind you, we will be reviewing the membership roll at the January board meeting. So if you intend to attend the annual business meeting, you have to be a member. So if you haven't taken care of that, you need to see one of the deacons. Also, again, a reminder, there's no Bible class this Wednesday. So you'll have a day off there. And then, of course, next Sunday, there will be no Bible class. This is the 18th, right? Yeah, so next Sunday will be the 25th. And also, if somebody has some time this week, if somebody wants to come and clean, see me on that. All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship. Let's continue on here, dealing with, again, one of our first imperatives with regard to what goes on in the local body, but again, an imperative that's directed specifically to the individual view that one has of himself. The non-hypocritical love is people thinking the same thing toward one another. It's people not thinking the high things, engaging in arrogance. But it is people associating with lowly people. And then the command to the individual, do not become wise in your own estimation. Again, to all the believers there, it's a second person plural, but really, obviously, it has to be applied on an individual basis. So we left off here with point 16. Therefore, here now, believers are to engage in a lifestyle that involves a mutual reciprocity with other believers, both giving to and receiving from one another. Financially, physically, emotionally, spiritually, every manner of life, every aspect of life, honoring and respecting one another, as he had said previously there, not lagging behind in diligence, but contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality, and being devoted to one another to the point of self-sacrifice. 17, Paul follows this exhortation with a negated use of the participle phroneo, thinking or having a mindset that focuses on a faulty way of thinking that is characteristic of pride, which will make the previous exhortation to harmony impossible. Again, this not being haughty in mind is literally not thinking the high things. So 18 here, Paul has already used this construction minus one definite article previously in Romans when he warned the Gentiles about the danger of arrogance toward the Jews. That's in Romans 11. And again here, when he's dealing with arrogance and that side of mindset, he does not mind using imperatives. This is something Paul thinks is important. He talks about the Jews being broken off for their unbelief. But you stand by your faith. Do not be conceited. Without the definite article, it's not high things thinking. They just have the definite article in our verse in Romans 12 there. So he's warned about that. 19, the phrase translated in English as do not be haughty in mind is literally do not think the high things. This expression is one that denotes the arrogant mindset of one that is impressed with himself, his position, his accomplishments, etc. And 20, while that same expression can mean to let the mind dwell on lofty or exalted concepts, it is used here in a negative way of about thinking too highly of oneself. An arrogant person thinks too highly of himself, that thinks too highly of himself often thinks little of others. And this mindset is the great enemy of unity. People have to have a humble mindset if you're going to have unity, if you're going to be one peace with one another. It has to come through humility. This is emphasized throughout Scripture, the necessity of humility. 21, the quality of arrogance is not consistent with non-hypocritical love. However, Paul sets forth a positive quality that is consistent with love. In verse 16, the next part, but associating with the lowly people. So 22, the adjective to pinos Literally low or low-lying. I mean, it could be used geographically of some place that was lower than another place, like the Dead Sea, say, below sea level. But it also means low in the sense of downtrodden, unassuming, these sorts of things. So it's used in Greek writings to denote things or people that were poor, weak, insignificant, or trivial. There are very few instances in which the term does not have the derogatory sense of one who is slavish, groveling, or mean-spirited. And that's how the Greeks tended to view this. That's why they didn't like this concept. They believed it was something that was characteristic of a lower person in society. One who was a slave, even. But a lower quality character. And that's the way they looked at it. So the Greeks, point 23, tended to believe that a noble mind and virtue were inherited and could not be acquired. So if you weren't born into it, too bad. But that was their view of it, generally speaking. Thus, the man who was born into lowly circumstances, especially slaves, was possessed by an obsequious nature. Obsequious means engaging in flattery and servile fawning to an excessive degree. Just whatever you say, you know. There was this one, I remember back when I first was on doctrine, I went to Maranatha there. There was this one guy, and when he would talk to the pastor, he'd always say, whatever you want, boss. Just whatever it is, boss. And I was like, okay. I don't see anything where we're supposed to be calling him boss, but all right, that's what seems weird to me. But this was just, to me, it was excessive. It just stood out as this isn't necessary. I mean, and certainly Jack never ran around and said, well, you guys got to call me boss all the time. He never did that. That wasn't his deal. But I thought to myself, you're just fawning over him is all you're doing. And maybe you think it's cool or humble or whatever you think it is. But it's not. So, again, there's a right way to treat people in authority. And I understand that. And I'm not saying, you know, we're not advocating here for, well, just dismiss authority and treat people any old way you want. But then there's that suck up, that brown noser. And you know what those type of people are like. You've probably seen them in operation. And hopefully none of us. So, again, they tended to think that a person who was topinos was somebody not to be admired, that this was a bad quality to have. And it was really, again, characteristic of the lower segments of society, is the way they looked at it. So 24, it was used in the Septuagint to reference the poor. 1 Samuel 18:23, and again, this is just the Hebrew or the Greek word that they used to translate certain Hebrew words in the Septuagint. So it's used of the poor in 1 Samuel 18:23. It's used of the weak in Judges 6:15. It's used of the afflicted or discouraged, Psalm 34. It's used of the lowly, Psalm 138:6. And it's used of the downtrodden and or oppressed, Psalm 10:18. So it's used of a lot of people. And those qualities, again, the words it's translating, of course, are not all the same Hebrew word, but the words they're translating are what are in some cases good qualities. It's good to not think too highly of yourself. It's good to be able to associate with just anyone. And I've seen kind of two things in this over the course of my life. I've seen, you know, the person, the curtain climber that just going to get ahead. They want their name up there. They want to only associate with certain types of people, be among the elite, the hobnobbers, you know, all of that. I never was interested in that. And that's one extreme. And then I've seen the other extreme of reverse discrimination, where a person who had somewhat humble, lowly circumstances, I've seen people like that who said, well, they're rich, so obviously, you know, they can't be spiritual. And there's a kind of, there could be a reverse discrimination that goes on from people who may not have. I remember, and they were halfway kidding me, but they weren't. You know, you get those type of people, kind of passive aggressive sort of thing, where they're halfway kidding, but they're not. And I remember when we first started going to Maranatha, well, most of us lived on the south side of town, downtown, or on the south side of Oklahoma City, and very few of us lived up on the north side. Well, the north side was the more affluent, elite part of the city, generally speaking. And so I had to move out to the north side of Oklahoma City because I had to get out there to simplify my niche. I was enrolling in seminary, and I had to get 5 Bible classes a week plus seminary, plus I had to get a job out there. I didn't want to keep working. Well, I couldn't keep working for the Baptists. They wouldn't let me teach the truth, so I had to quit, or they fired me. Which, again, that's the timing on that was good, although I didn't care for it at the time. I see now, you know, God was in that and got me out of there and all that. And this one person would say to me, he'd say, well, you know, can you really still associate with us? We don't live on the north side. Mm-hmm. And he was halfway kidding, but halfway serious. And there was this sort of reverse discrimination mindset. Oh, you're from the north side. Oh. So now we're going to draw geographic lines across the city. And if you're on this side of the line, Reno, say, then okay, you're fine. And then if you're on the other side, well, the Red Dog was north of Reno. And that's not, for those of you who know Oklahoma City, you know where I'm talking about. That wasn't necessarily a good part of town. I mean, I only went there to do research. I never went there. All right, I never went there. But that was a high crime area, but that was the north side, as it were. It was up on Northeast 10th or Northwest 10th. So, no, there's two extremes, and you don't want to get into either one of them. But these qualities here, however, this quality is one of which God approves, particularly when that lowly situation is a result of humbling oneself and pursuing God's plan. Some people are lowly because they've humbled themselves. They've chosen to be lowly. Zephaniah 2:3. This is when it's really good to have the electronic version, because you're thinking, where's Zephaniah? Which book? Where's that at again? Or you've got, you know, the little cheat things on the side of your Bible so you can quickly get to the tabs. Seek the Lord, all you humble of the earth who have carried out his ordinances. Seek righteousness. Seek humility. Perhaps you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. And also, same book, chapter 3, verse 12. So God views being lowly as a good thing, whereas the cosmos tends to look at it as no. No, it's not a good thing. But I will leave among you a humble and lowly people, and they will take refuge in the name of the Lord. 26, God promises to save and exalt the oppressed, those of humble circumstances. Isaiah 66:2, and to abase and overthrow the mighty and arrogant oppressors. Let's face it, very often the people who have power and money are the people who do some of the worst wrong in the world. They abuse people, they take advantage of people. And God's not in that. Isaiah 66:2, they talked about who could make him a deal for my house on which he could live, or a place where I can rest. How are you going to do that? Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. For my hand, he said, made all these things. Thus all these things came into being, declares the Lord. But to this one I will look. And what does it mean I will look? It doesn't mean he just looks at it. The idea here is have regard for, to look at favorably, to approve of, to him who is humble and contrite of spirit, and who trembles at my word. And so again, any sound recognition of who you are, or if you evaluate yourself according to standards of righteousness, Humble humility and contrition should characterize us, because we do fail. We all fall short. And what have you got to be arrogant about? What do you have that you didn't receive? That's what Paul asked the Corinthians. What makes you so great? What do you have that you didn't receive? First, in terms of doctrinal teaching, and secondly, in terms of physical things in this world. What do you have that you didn't receive? Somebody else probably helped you get it, if you've got it, or gave it to you, in fact. So, who will I look to? Who do I have regard for? The humble and contrite of spirit. And he's going to overthrow the mighty and arrogant oppressors. These are, again, the people that abuse others, who take advantage of them. I watch some of these shows on Nat Geo and Discovery and like that. And there's this guy. Of course, everybody's out hunting gold nowadays. That's the big deal, I guess. We're going to be gold miners. And so, but there's this one. They went down to this place in, somewhere in New Guinea, I think it is, down in that area there. And so they're looking to mine and all of that. Well, the islanders don't trust them, because they said, the white man's been in here before and he was awful. So how can we trust the white man? Why? Well, because they went in there and exploited and abused people and acted the part of the oppressor. And so that's what they remember. And so that's, but God's going to overthrow those types of people. People that take advantage of others, who exploit them for their own ends. Psalm 18, 27, for you save an afflicted people, but haughty eyes you abase. Again, if you're arrogant, God becomes your enemy. God will humble you. And that's a big part of the Christian life, is us being humbled as we go. Learning, okay, wait a second. I'm not the be-all and end-all I thought I was when I was 18, when I knew everything. We should have died then while we knew everything. It would have been better. But over the years, I've seen God, you know, frankly, sometimes just kick the crap out of me. I don't want to soften it, because it can be painful. And you realize, oh, okay, I'm not all that in a bag of chips like I thought I was. And I'm not the greatest thing since Frosted Flakes, you know. So you just learn, well, okay, you better be humble with God, because he does not put up with it. Now, other people may have to put up with our nonsense, but God doesn't. And he won't. Well, 27, the New Testament generally uses this family of words in a positive sense to denote those that are humble in spirit. For instance, Matthew 11. Matthew 11, 29. Actually, the thought begins in verse 28. Come to me, all who are weary and burdened down, heavy laden. You carry all these burdens, whatever burdens you're carrying, and I will give you rest. Now, the idea of peace from all of this. Relief. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So those who recognize, again here, that they are unworthy objects of God's grace and mercy. Luke 18, I'm sure that's in the context of the Pharisee and the tax collector praying. I'm sure. Yeah, it is. But again, note here, as they do this, the Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself. That's good, because God's not listening. So he's at least got an audience. But his prayers are get caught right about here in his nose. They never got above his nose. They got stuck there. And he was praying to himself, God, I thank you. And you can just hear him. I thank you, Lord, that I am not like other people. I'm so damn much better. And you know it, Lord, and I know it. And let's just have, you know, why am I even talking to you? You may not be worthy of me, Lord. You know, the arrogance that people manifest. I'm not a swindler, unjust, adulterers, or even like this stinking tax collector. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all that I get. I. How many times does he use I in this? Listen and read and watch, and you'll know where people are coming from. How much of it's I, me, and mine? What is it they talk about? Are they consumed with themselves? You can't hide it in your speech. It comes out. But the tax collector, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. I tell you, this man went to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. So there's two ways to get humility. There's the easy way, and then there's God's way. The easy way is you humble yourself. God's way is he'll humble you. And he can make it sting when he humbles you. He can make you see right away, well, you're not really all that important, are you? God's plan first, one of the things I try to keep before me at all the time. God's plan was going on and was doing just fine prior to my birth. And it'll be going just fine, I mean, absent the rapture, it'll be going just fine after my death, if I die. I just have my little time in history where I'm allowed to contribute to it and participate in it. But the plan's way bigger than me. And my part in it is, you know, as you see it, somewhat insignificant. That God even allows people a part in his plan, even shares his glory with them. Why? He doesn't have to. He chooses to because of his nature. So again, those that see recognize that they are unworthy objects of God's grace and mercy. You can also see Colossians 3:12. And those that recognize their dependence upon God and submit to his will. 1 Peter 5, 6. And it starts off again with the need for humility in verse 5. Younger men likewise. Peter's whole book is about subjection to various authorities and things in life. That's a lot of what 1 Peter is about, his orientation to authority. Be subject to your elders. And all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. God is omnipotent. He can do anything in your life that he wants to. It's just waiting for God to act rather than doing it on your own. Now, obviously, with the mind, the man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. We have to take action. I mean, we have to prioritize. We have to take action about making sure our priorities are fulfilled. We're expected to cooperate with God in this. But for the most part, we have to let God do it and not be too quick to try to do it ourselves. Now, obviously, you know, there are certain things you've got to do. You just don't have any choice. If you've got bills, you've got to pay them. But again, you humble yourself under God's hand. You say, okay, Father, here's my goal. Here's my plans. Here's the priorities biblically as I understand them. I need to get there. And that's what I need to do. And then work in that direction. Now, you may not get there immediately. But if you're working in that direction, you'll eventually get there. God will honor that if we keep our priorities straight. So you humble yourselves under God's omnipotence, rather. So that he may exalt you at the proper time. And there's a time for your exaltation. It may not be in this life. It may be. It depends. We don't know. This is where, when it comes to vindication, don't seek it. God will have to vindicate you. And again, you only really want his vindication anyway. It's his judgment that matters in all of this, not other people's. So you recognize your dependence on God and you submit to him. 28, the Greek adjective tapinos had been interpreted in a couple of ways since the form of that adjective is identical in both the masculine and neuter genders. A, if one parses the adjective as a neuter, it would mean that Paul is indicating that believers should be willing to engage in humble tasks or lowly service. And this understanding is attractive since the adjective is the opposite of the previous adjective, hupselos, which is definitely neuter in form. Now that one we know because of the way the parsing, as you parse it out, we can tell that one's definitely neuter. There's no doubt. The other option is to parse the adjective as a masculine, which is the correct one, by the way, which would mean that Paul is referring to lowly, needy, poor, or humble people. And see, in this case, the decision is relatively simple, since the adjective tapinos is only used 8 times in the New Testament, and all refer to people, every usage. So that one made it kind of easy. Sometimes it's not that easy. These are the kind of things when you're studying, you like to find the easy answer. Okay, I don't have to spend all time. I can just look at these 8 verses and I see every time it's used of people. Matthew 11:29, that one we just actually looked at. Luke 1, that's I believe either Mary or Elizabeth's speech. Luke 1, where are we, 52. Mary's speech. Luke, here, where are we at? 152. He has brought down rulers from their thrones, and he has exalted those who were humble. And you can also see James 1:9 and 4:6. Those are used to people as well. D, the final fact that clinches this interpretation is the use of the verb soon, apago, to lead away with someone, which means to join the company of another, to associate with someone. While the other two usages in the New Testament refer to being misled by people, it's only used three times. This use is a positive one. Galatians 2:13 is an example of this used in a negative sense. The rest of the Jews joined him, Peter, in hypocrisy, with the result that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. That carried away is the verb there. He began to associate with them in this legalism and was started doing some of these Judaistic things in order to oppress and impress the Judaizers. You can also see 2 Peter 3:17. It's used there of people, but in a bad sense. Being led away by their false teachings and all. So thus, Paul is indicating that non-hypocritical love is manifested by associating with those that may be inferior to another in rank, status, economic ability, or reputation. Believers should not only seek out those with social status, influence, or wealth, people who can do things for them. This is part of a natural human tendency that we have to avoid. It's natural to want to have, you know, if people have wealth and you don't mind profiting from that. That's natural human tendencies at some level. But we have to avoid that. This is not how believers are to pursue these things. In 29, the final portion of verse 16 has one of the few imperatives in this chapter. However, it reflects the idea, a similar idea, to what was found in the previous chapter. Now, in Romans 11 there, again, not identical, but similar here, is what he says in Romans 11:25. I do not want you, brothers, to be uninformed of this mystery, the mystery of the hardening of the Jews, so that you will not be wise in your own estimation. To not be wise in your own estimation is similar to what he says here now in verse 16. Not exactly identical in the Greek, but similar enough that it's translated the same. Don't be wise in your own estimation. So 30, given the similarity of thought and the similarity of the Greek of the Septuagint, it appears that Paul's command here is taken from the book of Proverbs. Solomon links this type of behavior with a fool, and Isaiah pronounces a woe on those who exhibit this quality. Proverbs 3:7. And there it's translated in the, well, at least the Net Bible, do not be wise in your own estimation. And again, para seau tu, among yourselves. New American Standard has it, do not be wise in your own eyes. Because it does use the word eyes there in the Hebrew. It's the literal ayin. It's the word for eyes. The dual. Hebrew things that come in pairs are always duals in the Hebrew. To be wise in your own eyes is in your own opinion, your own estimation, your own view of things. You can tend to, the eyes see things, they view things. Not in a literal sense, obviously, here in the mental sense. So it appears, again, that Paul's command is taken from Proverbs, and Solomon links this sort of behavior with the fool. Proverbs 12:15. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes. Well, that's right. You never talk to somebody that's stupid and they tell you, are you sure you're doing yet right? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm fine. Well, you know, it really seems dumb what you're doing. Yeah, no, I'm fine. I'm right. I know I'm right. And there are some people, it didn't matter what you tell them, it doesn't matter how wrong they are, you could never convince them that they were wrong. Again, these are the type of people that if they think it, it must be right because they think it. Just because you think it doesn't make it right. Just because I think it doesn't make it right. This is where we have to take every thought captive. Some of our thoughts are right, some of them are wrong. We have to be diligent to deal with those. Okay, this is a wrong thought. I shouldn't think this way. Where'd that thought come from? That's not biblical. And so you recognize as you get, you know, this battle goes on forever, but you should get better at it as you go, of taking these thoughts captive, because you realize you're learning more doctrine, you've got more wherewithal, more understanding. It should be easier to judge. And then sometimes you just realize, well, it isn't pretty, but yeah, that's what it is. So the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice. Say, fools don't bother with advice. You can offer them all the advice you want. They're going to go do it their way. And that's a characteristic of a fool. Don't just say, I'm going to do it my way because I'm sure my way is right. That is a bad quality to have, a bad attitude. And Isaiah, again, pronounces a woe on these types of people. Isaiah 5, 21. Woe. The Hebrew term oi. It's like an onomatopoeic word. It's supposed to be kind of like what it sounds like, what it's conveying. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. You're just impressed with yourself of how good you are, how talented, how oriented in all things. Well, guess what? We're not. And it's a wise person that recognizes their limitations. Know your limitations. And don't try to fool yourself. Don't delude yourself. There are people, the Bible talks about this all the time, about this self-delusion under which people live. Because they want to think a certain way, and they want things to be a certain way. So they convince themselves that it is that way, even when it's not. And that's not good. Well, the negative may, no or not, is coupled with the present imperative of the verb genoma. To become, to enter a new state or condition. To form a prohibition against pride. And 32, the use of that verb instead of the verb eimi, to be or are, the to be verb, would indicate that Paul did not believe the Romans were guilty of being arrogant. That's subtle but important, I think, in that he doesn't attribute arrogance to them. He says, don't get this way. Which implies that his view is they're not now. And so, again, Paul has not used a very strong hand through this. He doesn't use a lot of commands. And when he does talk to them, as you pay careful attention to what he says, he implies to me, everything I've seen in Romans so far to me, implies that the Roman church was apparently fairly oriented. There isn't a lot of things. And the one that's coming up, really, people say, well, these two things coming up, like chapter 13 about the government, and then chapter 14, the strong and the weak, prove they had these problems. I don't think they prove it. I think Paul included it in his letter, but I don't see anything. I haven't gone through chapter 13 already. I didn't see anything in there that suggested to me that he thought they were not doing this. The fact that he includes it, you know, is sort of preventive maintenance. It's a warning shot across the bow, as it were, rather than, oh, you're guilty of this. It's don't become guilty of it. And that's kind of what he says here with this deal of do not become wise. It implies that they're not now. They haven't engaged in this. And that he doesn't want them to in the future. This would indicate that Paul did not believe the Romans were guilty of being arrogant. Rather, this is to be construed as a warning against that potential development. In 33, the adjective Paul uses is phronimos, wise, which is related to the noun phrein. That's the word for thinking, the thinking processes, the faculties of thinking, perceiving, and drawing reasoned and sound conclusions. Thinking is an art form. Most people don't learn it because, number one, we've removed, in a lot of cases, we've removed logic from our schools. We've engaged in revisionist history. People really don't know the past. They aren't forced to learn things anymore in some ways. They go out and they do this regularly on these shows. I don't remember anyone recently, but I know I've seen them before. Well, they'll go out and ask people some basic, easy questions. You know, what's the capital of California? They won't know. Los Angeles? No, it's not Los Angeles. Do you know where the state? They couldn't find Connecticut on a map. You know, and this type of stuff, the dumb stuff that you think, well, man, I learned that early on. Well, you should have. You should have learned it early on. And they'll ask them just basic, easy questions, and these people will just be drawing a blank. You know? And I know with the change of times, but we were warned about this in Ecclesiastes. Solomon said, made it very plain, the world has a short memory. A generation comes and a generation goes. The one that's coming doesn't care about what the one that's been there did. And once they get there, they won't care at all. They'll forget it. And then somebody else will replace them. And so, you know, you go through the baby boomer generations. Then you go into whatever the next one theoretically was. Gen X, Gen Y, the millennials, blah, blah, blah. Well, guess what? Everybody forgets, and they forget quickly. Given another 50 years, they won't know who the Beatles were. And that's not important. but it shows that there's no continuity, certainly in terms of history, with most people. And they just don't know certain things, which is sad. And they ought to be taught how to reason and logic. This is why everybody ought to be forced to take geometry. Just so you learn how to present a proof. And you say, I hated geometry. I'm sure you did. I loved it. To me, I loved the logic of it. You had to move from point A to point B to point C. And some people, they had this intuitive way they worked. And they'd get the answer right, but they couldn't show you how to do it. Yeah, I might get the answer right. Well, do I get points for getting the answer right? No, you didn't show your work. And so that, and geometry, that was one of the things. You always had to show your work. You had to show your logical progression of thought, how you proved side, angle, side, or whatever the theory was that you had to prove, the theorem. So again, people ought to be taught to think logically. They're not. And they don't even realize that they don't think logically. That's what's even sadder. 1 Corinthians 14:20. Brothers, do not be children in your thinking. Children don't think logically. They don't have any experience, really, to speak of. They don't really know what the world's all about. They haven't been out there in it. They haven't experienced the glory that is humanity at its best and worst. And mostly its worst. Do not be children in your thinking processes. Yet in evil be infants, but in your thinking processes be mature. Grow up. And again, we know how little kids think. Mine. You have to teach them to share. They don't know that. We have to teach them not to be self-centered. We have to teach, and they always pick up, what was the first word, kids? Inevitably, those of you who raise kids know, what was the first word they learned? No. Exactly. No. How did they learn it first? Because that's the first word they heard the most. No, 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 no. That's what you have to tell them. No, no, get your finger out of that socket. No, don't run in the street. No, no, stop swinging the cat into the Christmas tree. Get the dog out of the microwave. Don't do any of that. You have to tell them no, no, no. And that's the first word they learn. No, no. And that boy, they know it with attitude too, don't they? They don't just learn it. No. And boy, they express the arrogance. And this is two-year-olds. And people say, well, you can't discipline two-year-olds. You damn sure better. That's the problem we've got right now. And, why are these people the way they are today? Well, this kid that grew up in South Carolina, the one to start the race war, he grew up in an environment somewhere. Somebody's responsible for this nut job. But of course we can't hold the parents responsible. Now, I'm not saying he couldn't have just grown up and been a nut job. He could have. That happens. But these things happen in certain environments. That the parents are somewhat responsible for, at least. This is why you have to train kids early and often. No, no, discipline is a factor. Yes, that's the way it works. So grow up in your thinking processes. 34, it denotes the quality of thinking that has insight and is used to describe one who uses his head, one who is deemed to be wise, sensible, thoughtful, or prudent. Matthew 7:24. And everybody's not this way. That's sad, but it's true. Certainly we know the vast majority of mankind don't think this way because they reject Christ. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on a rock. Phronimos is the word that's used there. A man who is thoughtful, sensible, makes good choices, takes facts into consideration. A man that doesn't fly off the handle, that isn't flighty and flaky, and all these other things. A person that's sound and sober in their thought processes and their approach to life. And there are people that are just not like that. One of the things you see as people go on in life, and it doesn't matter what their thing to abuse is, if it's drugs or alcohol or whatever else, you see it begins to affect them. They don't think soundly. They make bad decisions. I can't think really of a time where I thought to myself, oh, I'm drunk, I'm really making good decisions now. The very fact that you're drunk means you haven't made good decisions. You wouldn't be there if you weren't. I'm having to redo the doctrine of wine and drinking, so I'm pretty stirred up about this one. But you don't make good decisions. And this is one of the things when you're drunk. This is why this is a metaphor that's used throughout Scripture to deal not with physical drunkenness. It does deal with that. But the reality of physical drunkenness and intoxication, what happens? You become disassociated from reality. And so, you know, as they used to say, one of the songs, I can't remember, he was singing a song about drinking. I'm 10 feet tall and bulletproof. No, you're not. You're about 5'7", and somebody's going to clean up the barroom floor with you if you don't watch it. Because when you drink, your perceptions are altered. We know this. And these altered perceptions lead to bad decisions. Oh, I feel lucky. I'm drinking. I feel lucky. Put it all on 23 black. I just know it. And whoops, sorry, you're broke. Oh, we're going to have to throw you out of your room, too. You can't pay for it, so bye. The casinos love you in Vegas if you spend money and lose. Yeah. But if people make bad decisions, then they're going to gamble. I feel lucky I'm going to the horse races. The greyhound races. So I've never felt that I needed to try to supplement my income with gambling. And I've never felt like gambling was the answer. But you watch people that drink and they do this all the time. You watch people that drink and their altered perceptions lead them into all kinds of behaviors that are, well, some gets flat out end up getting them killed. They can. Oh, I'm fine to drive. I'll be okay. And you're out there playing pinball with the curbs, you know. That's not good. So, but the people who aren't sober and sound and have good thinking processes, they're not going to be successful in life. They're not going to be successful in Christianity. He's compared to a wise man who built his house on a solid foundation. He didn't build on Siesta Key, Longboat Key, Captiva, Marco Island. Pick the place where you're building on sand. And hope when it comes, and of course this area is due. We never know when we're going to get it. It missed us now for 40-something years, but it could happen. And when it happens, I guarantee you the construction out there won't last. You know, because the foundation is bad to start with, and if your foundation's bad in life, you got real trouble. Matthew also chapter 10, verse 16. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. Shrewd is again our term, phronimos. Be thoughtful out here. You're in the angelic conflict. You're a target. You're in a warfare. Think about what you're doing. Think about how you're living. Think about the choices you make. And then think about these things in terms of, one, how do they impact others around me? My bad choice, and people say, well, it's my bad choice, I made it, it didn't impact anybody. Our bad choices always affect other people. This idea that you can make bad choices in a vacuum, that there's no impact anywhere at any time, that's just not right. That's incorrect thinking. Bad choices affect people. And it may not affect people in great dramatic ways necessarily, but they may. You know? Somebody gets in the car with you and you're driving and you're drunk, and they could end up dead because of your bad choice. So obviously we have to make good choices. We should. And then here the word is translated shrewd in that you're supposed to be thoughtful and discerning, exercising discrimination out here. Don't just be sucked into anything. And that's most people. They don't stand for anything. So they fall for everything. That's a lot of people. They don't have discernment, discretion. They're not shrewd. So when the Greek noun phronimos, having insight, wise, sensible, or thoughtful, is coupled with the dative of the reflexive pronoun, which it is in our verse in Romans, it conveys the idea of being wise in your own estimation, relying on your own wisdom. And 36, while the verse in chapter 11 did not use a preposition with the reflexive pronoun, the use of the preposition para in verse 16 here does not affect its meaning. You can be wise if you use, you can just use the dative of the pronoun itself. You don't have to have a preposition for this. They do because it ends the idea of alongside yourselves. Don't get together in a group and engage in some sort of mutual admiration society. Well, let's pat each other on the back because we're all wonderful and let's not think about anything else. That isn't very wise. That leads to bad outcomes. I mean, there's a time and a place for congratulating people. I'm not saying you can't encourage people or compliment them. But I'm saying when you get together as a group and it's just a mutual admiration society, that's all it is. That's counterproductive in life. Because you don't stop and think about the failures and the downside that we all have, that we all have to deal with. So when the preposition para is used with a dative case, it normally denotes the idea of what is beside or nearby. It is regularly used to denote the one whose viewpoint is relevant and can be translated as in the sight of, in the judgment of, or opinion of. For instance, 1 Corinthians 3:19. And verse 18 is actually good too here. Let no man deceive himself. This is the biggest thing we have to fight as believers, is self-deception. That because we think it's it. That there's no other way it can be. If any man among you thinks he is wise in this age, he must become foolish so that he can actually find out what real wisdom is. And the real wisdom isn't the wisdom of this world. There is a certain wisdom out there in the world. You'd be foolish to say that there's not. There's a certain wisdom, and then there's stuff that passes as wisdom, which actually isn't. But the world has a way of doing things, and it has its own system of wisdom. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness before God. For it is written, he is the one who catches the wise in their craftiness. And what you have there in the Greek, the wisdom of this world is para. Well, actually, you got the word moria, the noun there. We get our word moron. The wisdom of this world is moronic before God, or in the sight of God, or in the opinion of God. So, if it's God's opinion that this world's wisdom isn't of any value, then it's going to become my opinion. And that's why it's easy to write it off, because at that level, you know that God's already sorted all this out. He knows. If the cosmos had something to offer us, he would tell us, I'm sure. But he tells us that they don't really have anything to offer. All they can do is pay you a livable wage so you can pursue the Christian life. That's all they can really do for you at that level. And, you know, if they do anything more than beyond that, well, I guess you're just fortunate. You know, some people would call it lucky. Well, the cosmos, you know, they have their own way of doing things. But we don't, I'm not involved with them. I don't care to be involved with them. They're enemies of God. Their wisdom isn't wise, in fact. It's very foolish. And James 1:27 also. Pure and undefiled religion in the sight of God. Actually, here you just have para to theo, alongside the God. So in God's estimation, real evidences of Christianity are helping the unfortunate, to visit orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained by the cosmos, to not be sucked into their, again, similar to what we had there in Romans chapter 12. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. They will get you dirty. That's all they can do. They cannot communicate cleanness. So 38 here, thus Paul prohibits the Romans from subjectively evaluating themselves and adopting the position that they are somehow superior to those that are in a lower intellectual, social, monetary position. Again, or social position doesn't make any difference. Governmental position, relative power and authority in this world. These people, again, you're not superior to people just because they may have less money than you. So what? Money is not how we evaluate each other, is it? It shouldn't be. I mean, but that's the way the cosmos operates. They operate very much on how much money you got. In fact, certain things are keyed to how much money you got. Your credit rating, for instance, is keyed to this. And even what you pay in insurance. I mean, they got some real scams that they perpetrate on the American public. You shouldn't have to pay more for insurance because you're poor. Because you don't have the resources other people have. In fact, you probably should be paying less, truth be told. But they have these ways of judging you and evaluating you. And if you don't live up to their criteria, well, that's just too bad. Well, 39, this prohibition is given here since it is closely connected with the preceding context. Arrogance and contempt for those that occupy a lower position in this world is normally the result of having an inflated view of one's, that should be one's own importance, importance. So people that think highly of themselves, well, guess what? They tend to think lowly of others. Don't be that way. This is what we're exhorted to avoid. Okay, well, we got just a couple of minutes, so we're going to have the doctrine of pride, which we will bring that and have that ready. We will get to that on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the time together to fellowship in the things of your word. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us with respect to these things. In Christ's name, amen.